25 years ago, an Iowa farmer and baseball fan started hearing voices.
If you build it, you will come.
Today, we mark the 25th anniversary of Field of Dreams. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This week marks the 25th anniversary of the release of the movie Field of Dreams. The movie touched millions in a profound way, and the field that was left behind in Dyersville has taken on a life, often a contentious life, of its own. This hour, I'll talk with the man behind the story, people involved in the making of the film, and some of the ghost players who've kept the legend alive in Dyersville. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This week marks the 25th anniversary of the release of the movie Field of Dreams. The movie, of course, tells the story of Ray Kinsella, played by Kevin Costner. He's an Iowa farmer and a baseball fan who is sent on a quest by a mysterious voice.
Annie, what was that?
What was what?
That voice just now. What was it?
We didn't hear anything.
All right.
If you build it, he will come.
Okay, you must have heard that.
Sorry. Hey, come on in to dinner.
This hour, we'll talk about why this movie touched so many and how it continues to affect people. We'll also talk about the legacy that was left behind at the film site in Dyersville. But first, most of us came to know and love Ray Kinsella through the movie Field of Dreams. But before Kevin Costner played him on the big screen, he came to life on the pages of a novel, Shoeless Joe, written by W.P. Kinsella. I spoke with him last fall during Iowa Public Radio's Iowa Week. He grew up in Canada and didn't go to college until he was in his mid-30s. After going to school at the University of Victoria, W.P. Kinsella came to the Iowa Writers' Workshop at the University of Iowa. I asked him what brought him here.
Well, it was the workshop. It is known probably as the best writing program in North America, and I was lucky enough to be admitted there.
Did you know anything about Iowa before you came here?
Very little, actually. I had never been there at all.
And was Shoeless Joe actually written during your time at the workshop?
Shoeless Joe began as a story called Shoeless Joe Jackson Comes to Iowa. That was written while I was there. And it was published in an anthology, and a young editor at Houghton Mifflin Publishers in Boston read the review of the anthology, and he thought the story idea was so wonderful that he got in touch with me and said, if this is part of a novel, we really want to see it, and if it isn't, it should be.
How would you describe Ray Kinsella?
He's a little naive. He believes in magical things and is willing to follow a dream, and that's essentially what the book is about: someone who is willing to follow a somewhat elusive dream to completion.
Did you have anything to do with making the movie or moving the story from the book to the movie Field of Dreams?
No, I didn't. It was adapted by Phil Alden Robinson, who also directed the movie. Phil kept in touch with me while he was writing it because he was so in love with the book that he wanted to do something really special, and he kept telling me, he said, look, there is no way that we can get a 300-page novel into an hour and 40-minute movie. We have to telescope time. We have to cut characters. And he and I said, well, I said, I don't mind. I said, it's writing a novel is like baking a loaf of bread. When someone buys it, it's none of my business if they paid for it properly, whether they make it into dainty sandwiches or whether they break it up and feed it to their chickens. So do what you have to do to make it a good movie.
And do you think it's a good movie? Do you like it?
Oh, I love it. I'm one of the few authors who likes what Hollywood did with their book. I mean, usually they make a terrible mess of it. Which they've done another movie that I had made of one of my books. And I think Thomas Keneally of Schindler's List is the only other author I've met who really liked what Hollywood had done with his book.
So in writing about Iowa, as someone who didn't live here very long, what were some of the important things about Iowa and Iowans that made it into your work?
I felt an immediate affinity for Iowa. I liked the humidity. I've come from the prairies where it's dry. I love this humidity where you can walk down the street and part the air in front of your face when it's so hot and damp. And I really liked that. And of course, the people were wonderfully friendly. I liked Iowa City very much. I liked going out to the Amana colonies, and I liked the you could just feel the corn growing. The atmosphere was just full of it, and I liked that very much.
These days, the Field of Dreams has been preserved in Iowa, and it attracts thousands of visitors every year, even in Coralville, Iowa City, there is a ballpark where outside the baseball diamonds, they've planted three rows of corn to give people that kind of Field of Dreams feel. When we asked people about their favorite fictional Iowans, Ray Kinsella was at the top of the list. How does it feel to know that this character that you created has taken on this life and continues to live in Iowa?
Well, it's wonderful. I mean, that's the kind of thing that you hope will happen when you write a novel or a story or create fictional characters. It's called verisimilitude, the appearance of truth. I have one of the gifts that I apparently have is that I can create characters and situations where people said, yes, I believe that's the way it was. And I've been very fortunate that that has happened. And, of course, Don and Becky Lansing preserved the Field of Dreams. I believe they've sold it now, but it's going to be carried on and will be there long after I'm gone, which is a wonderful tribute. I love it.
Bill, thank you so much for your time today.
You're most welcome.
W.P. Kinsella is the author of Shoeless Joe, the novel that became the movie Field of Dreams. And of course, many people in Iowa are celebrating the 25th anniversary of the film. Tonight, the Dubuque International Film Festival opens with a star-studded reception and screening of the film at the University of Dubuque Heritage Center. And all this hour, we want to hear from you. What are your memories of the first time you saw Field of Dreams? Were you inspired to go out and try to recreate or create your own Field of Dreams on your property? I know a lot of people did it that summer. Have you visited the film site? You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. With me now is a woman who actually decided where the Field of Dreams would be. Sue Rydell is artistic director and stage manager for Dubuque's Bell Tower Theater. She had a little side job as the location scout and the local casting director for Field of Dreams. Hello, Sue.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, I'm really honored that you called me.
How did you get involved with Field of Dreams?
Well, I was a volunteer on the State Film Commission and also on the Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce Film Commission. And Wendell Jarvis from the State Film Office requested that we look for farms. They wanted to make a movie called Shoeless Joe. And he asked if I would look for farms in my area, in the Dubuque area. And so I went to the library and I got the book. And I read the book, and I guess I set up on my dream quest, and I went up and down farmland roads, up and down with my cheapy camera, and taking pictures of possible farms. I was told that they wanted a farm that had a white traditional farmhouse, white with a clapboard house, two-story. They wanted a wraparound porch. They wanted a fence. They wanted a long lane leading to it. It needed to sit by itself and totally be surrounded by corn and have enough land to build a baseball field. So that's what I was looking for, and I took pictures. When I came up over the hill to where the location of the Lansing farm was, I just thought it was perfect. You just can't, you come over the hill, and there it is, sitting there. And I had taken lots of pictures, and I went up and asked the farmers if I could send them into Universal Studios. So I took pictures of the Lansing farm, and I went up to his front door, and I knocked on the door, and he wasn't home. But I thought, gee, this is really the perfect location. So I took the pictures anyway. I sent them into Universal Studios. Of course, they called and said they'd like to see that farm. So now I had to own up to what I had done. And I knocked on Mr. Lansing's door and said, well, hi, my name is Sue Rydell, and I'm taking pictures for a possible movie that they want to make in this area, and your farm fits the description. And I sent the picture of your farm into Universal Studios, and now they'd like to come here and talk to you, and maybe they'll make a movie here. And he said, are you dreaming? Are you crazy? And I said, no, let me go through this again. So I explained it to him, and he said, well, do I have anything to lose? And I said, no, you can always say no. Luckily, he didn't say no. And so they did, long story short, they did come here and select that farm. We did go to Universal Studios, though. They narrowed it down to three farms, not all of them in Iowa. And Rob Apple from the Dubuque Area Chamber of Commerce, who was the head at that time, Wendell Jarvis from the Iowa Film Office, and myself went to Universal and to persuade them to come to Iowa and to to film in our state, because we thought the integrity of the film would be good. Obviously, the economic impact is wonderful if they come to your area. And we thought that we had other locations, too, because the terrain is, there's a variety of terrain, and we could be a lot of different locations.
It's hard to imagine this movie not being filmed in Iowa, although, of course, we have seen many other places stand in for Iowa and many other films over the years. Sue, we have to take a short break. We're going to be back in just a moment, and I'm going to talk to Dwyer Brown, who played the father, John Kinsella, in the movie Field of Dreams. And then I'm going to talk more with Sue Rydell. She is artistic director and stage manager for Dubuque's Bell Tower Theater. She also was credited as Batgirl on Field of Dreams. She was a location scout and also did local casting as well. We'll talk more in a moment. And of course, we do want to hear from you this hour. What does this movie mean to you? This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're marking the 25th anniversary of Field of Dreams. We love the movie because it's a visual love letter to Iowa. We love it because it's a baseball movie. But most of all, we love it because it's about the relationship between a father and a son, two men who get an unexpected second chance to make things right.
Can I ask you something? Is this heaven?
It's Iowa.
Iowa?
Yeah.
Could have sworn it was heaven.
Is there a heaven?
Place dreams come true.
Dwyer Brown played John Kinsella, Ray Kinsella's dad, in the movie. He was only on screen for about 5 minutes, but it was a 5 minutes that touched many people and has followed him through the last 25 years. He's written a book inspired by the stories fans have shared with him. It's called If You Build It, a book about fathers, fate, and Field of Dreams. Hello, Dwyer.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And this was a small role, but it's really the emotional heart of the movie. When you were filming that scene with Kevin Costner, could you feel the power of what you were doing?
It's one of those experiences that that I've had a few times in film work. I started out as a stage actor, and so you can feel the audience in the theater. But on film, it's sometimes difficult because everybody's trying to be quiet. They're trying not to react. They can't make any noise. But sometimes you can feel when the energy around a scene has kind of forced the people that are there trying to, you know, be the dolly grips and hold the sound mics, and when they sort of get distracted by the performance. And so when the director yells cut, there's a kind of, a few seconds before people can kind of like pull themselves out of their emotional involvement with the scene and get back to their jobs. And fortunately, Field of Dreams was one of those moments where it did feel like the crew was involved in the scene, which is always, to me, the highest compliment you can get on a film shoot.
How aware were you of the rest of the movie when you shot your scene? Had you gotten to see any footage?
No, I got there very late in the shooting process. I was there for the last essentially 2 weeks of the shoot, and they had been there for, I think, about 2.5 months and had been dealing with all kinds of, horrible circumstances. I mean, it was a drought that summer in 88, and the corn wasn't growing, and you can imagine how silly that movie would have been if the ghost players were walking out of corn that's as high as their knees. It would have looked a little ridiculous. They would have had to do like a Groucho Marx pretend you're walking up steps move or something as they came out of the corn. So they were pretty frustrated by a lot of, sort of weather-related frustrations of the set. But I grew up on a farm in Ohio, so coming back to that farm was just heaven for me. I mean, it reminded me of the farm I grew up on, and to sort of have my childhood kind of meet my movie acting career in that way was just an added thrill for me. So
I know that you lost your dad shortly before you filmed Field of Dreams. How did playing this character affect how you felt about your dad?
Well, what was interesting about it was I thought that having my father die sort of unexpectedly 36 days before I was to report there to Iowa to shoot, I thought it would make me more emotional, that having that fresh wound would be, fuel for a stronger performance. But what I found was it was so close to me that I felt I was a little blocked, emotionally. And I also had an overwhelming sense with my dad that he sort of hadn't left the world. I mean, I was holding his hand when he died in the hospital, but I felt his presence, around me for the several weeks while we were going through his, funeral arrangements. And when I arrived at the set there, this is this old farmhouse like the one I had grown up in. It had been under construction because they were taking out walls to make it easier to shoot the film in there. And that's what I had done with my dad for 20 years with our farmhouse, is, tearing out walls and putting in windows. And so it was strange when the scene came around and I felt kind of like not prepared somehow to play the sort of father back from the dead when, in fact, my father had just so recently died. But I tell the story in the book about how I ended up being able to use that eventually, but it did worry me right up until, he said action for the first time we shot the scene.
Do you remember what it was like the first time you got to see that scene in the film and watch the whole thing all at once?
Yeah, actually. I mean, it happened at the cast and crew screening. What was strange is that it was, I had looked at it as just this small part in the movie. Now, I loved the script and I was very excited about it, but I just thought it was sort of the last little loose end of this film, and I was proud of it and all that. But only when I saw it at the cast and crew screening, I wasn't alone in realizing how, what a profound statement Phil Alden Robinson had made with his script and with this movie about the, archetypal relationship between fathers and sons. I think it had a lot to do with James Horner's score, which was so it just built so profoundly, you know, from those first wispy little sounds during the opening shot to the cornfield to, I mean, it felt like a thunderstorm by the time it gets to the end of the movie. And, you know, when that cloudburst opens, figuratively, it's my face there, you know, with Kevin for the final few moments. And I think all of us were surprised, and no one more than me, when we were watching that in the screening room and, you know, just kind of taking it in for the first time.
This is a role that has resonated with a lot of fans over the years. A lot of people have come up to you, recognized you, and told you stories about how this movie affected them, how it changed their relationship with their father or changed their relationship with their son. Obviously, that was the inspiration largely for the book that you've just published. Can you tell me briefly just one of those stories that really surprised you and moved you?
Well, I include about nine of them out of several dozen I have in the book. But I guess the one that comes to mind was sort of the first one, because it took me by surprise. A fellow walked up to me in a convenience grocery store, and I'd been camping for a few days, and I was just trying to get food together for breakfast, and I had like 3-day beard growth, and my hair was a mess, and I smelled all smoky, and this guy came up to me and was kind of looking at me and, you know, said, "Did we go to high school together?" And I said, "Well, I went to high school in Ohio. I don't think so." And suddenly his face just opened up, and he went, oh my gosh, you look like that guy from Field of Dreams. Anybody ever tell you that?" And I said, "No, actually, but I am that guy." And he couldn't believe it. I mean, after he'd already told me that's who he thought I was, when I said I was him, he didn't believe me. But anyway, as soon as he realized it was me, his eyes welled up with tears, and he just started telling me that he had never gotten along with his dad, but he'd gone to see that movie because he loved playing baseball, and he hadn't spoken to his dad in 15 years, and he saw the movie and drove up to Bakersfield and just grabbed his dad by the arm and told him to come with him, and they watched the movie at a local movie theater there, and they just sort of both realized how silly whatever they had been fighting about was, and they just sort of made up, you know, without really having to talk much about it. And and that story I've probably heard in various incarnations, you know, probably a dozen times. And I know Phil Robinson, the director, has had people come up to him, and the producers have received letters to that effect. And it's really pretty amazing. I think it's just what any artist wants to hear about something they were involved in, that it moved people in that way.
Dwyer Brown, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Hey, thank you. It's been great, and it's great to be back in Iowa.
Dwyer Brown played John Kinsella, the father in Field of Dreams. He's written If You Build It, a book about fathers, fate, and Field of Dreams. He'll be at the Dubuque International Film Festival this week, and he'll also return this summer for the big Father's Day 25th anniversary celebration in Dyersville. Sue Rydell is still with me. She is artistic director and stage manager for Dubuque's Bell Tower Theater, and as we were talking about before, she was also the location scout and did local casting for Field of Dreams when they shot here in Iowa. And Sue, talking to Dwyer there, he mentioned that there was a drought that summer when we were shooting. And, you know, if you look at Field of Dreams, the corn is so beautiful. It's so green. It's so lush. I know a couple of people who were from Iowa and watched the movie and actually had tears in their eyes just looking at the cornfield in the beginning of the movie because it made them so homesick. But all of that green didn't come easily, right?
Oh, no. It was the only corn that was tall that particular summer. No, they had to irrigate the corn. And in addition to that, they had to paint the grass and the corn to make sure that it was the right color, because that's such an important part in the movie. So Hollywood's magic took over.
Now, as you were helping out with the filming, how much time did you spend at the movie site?
Oh, I was there every day, and sometimes night and day. In the mornings, I'd go to baseball practice and with the guys, and they would practice their plays and that would be being shot that day. I also was on the set and took care of all the extras, whether it was the PTA meeting or, and then I was also involved with the last shot of the movie with all the cars It was my job to get 1,500 cars and 3,000 people, and then I had to line them up that day. And the shot that you see in the movie is the third take. So it was the biggest tailgate party in the state of Iowa that particular night, and everybody was so cooperative. And we used the car radios as a communication system so people knew in their cars what they should do, if they should move forward or blink their lights. And there were two radio stations, an AM and an FM station, cooperated to help us do that. So when you go to Hollywood, they thought that was all electronic, but that was really live people in Iowa working together to make a wonderful ending to a movie.
I remember I was living in Cedar Falls at the time, and I remember when the call went out for extras, and people came from all over Iowa to be in that scene at the end of the movie.
Yes, I had people from all over. You got a ticket to be in the last shot of the movie. You actually had to register because I had to know your car and your license number and type of car and everything so I could keep track of everybody for safety. And so I took the first 1,500 people. And they got tickets, and nobody else could be on the roads that night. The Highway Patrol helped, and we had porta-potties along by the trees, so people had to go to the restrooms. And we had a picnic in Commercial Club Park in Dyersville beforehand with hot dogs and various things. And then Brian, Frankish, and myself gave directions, and there were different roads that we had to cover. So you might be an A car, a B car, or a C car, and they were labeled, and then you went to your roads. And you listened on your radio, and there were interviews from the actors, and there was also directions on what to do. And then on your way home, we had drawings also over the radio, and on your way home you might have gotten some kind of prize or something to take home that you could pick up on your way out.
And it was, of course, it's so moving when those lights come over the horizon and you see all of these people coming to the field. To make sure that those lights were visible, you had to make a lot of arrangements with neighboring farmers and even towns to make sure there weren't already lights, right?
Oh, we had to contact all Iowa. There are lots of baseball games at that time of the year, and so we had to contact any type of baseball field within the area to be sure that there were no baseball lights on or there was no games. We had to talk to all the farmers, because the only lights you wanted to see was the car lights in that particular night. So organization was a lot of work. I had a lot of people that helped me and volunteered to help me with getting all of that accomplished. And so, and I think a lot of people were surprised that a girl did it. So it was quite an achievement, to deal with all of those people and to organize it. And we did it on budget. And the third take is the prettiest because the lights showed up so well. And so people were so cooperative. We did it three times. And
how many hours were people out there?
Oh, well, we started about, I can't remember the exact time, but around 5 o'clock or 4 o'clock at the picnic. And mm-hmm. So we got everybody in there, and they had something to eat. And then we headed for the roads. And also we had people taking water and peanuts and various things to your car, so you could, they had a little snack while they were out there on the road. So everyone was just really cooperative and no accidents, and it was a very successful project, and made the movie. People are still coming because they saw that. People really believed that if they got in their car and they drove to Iowa, they could come to the Dream Field.
And there were those 1,500 cars, but there were a lot of other Iowans who were in the movie. And we'll play a clip in a few minutes after our break from the PTA scene where there were a lot of Iowans in that picture. But also in a couple of minutes, we're going to talk to one of the ball players who was also from Iowa. You had a lot of coordinating to do to bring together a lot of Iowans to be in the film.
Well, we had an audition for baseball players, and Rod Dato, who was the winningest baseball coach in collegiate history from USC, and Don Buford from the Baltimore Orioles were here to pick the ball players, because you really had to play. I mean, you really had to look like you knew what you were doing. So we had auditions for the ball players. In addition, then the ones that were picked went to practice all the time, so they were good at doing plays. And then they also, the coaches worked with the actors that came from Hollywood to make sure that they could also play ball, and then everybody would work together. And we had two teams, of course. And the PTA meeting was 500 people, and Mr. Kinsella was, he came to be in the PTA meeting. He talked about that, and so that was kind of fun having him there. He wanted to just be involved in some way, and so he came to be in the PTA meeting. And that was so hot that day. It was, I don't know, over 100 degrees in that school.
Well,
and we had to put fans and everything.
Yeah, Sue, we'll play that scene in just a couple of minutes, and we'll talk more about it. We're going to talk to one of the ghost players and someone who made a documentary about the ghost players who performed at the field for 18 years after the movie was made. We will also talk with you. Give us a call. Join the conversation. Let us know what this movie means or meant to you. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're marking the 25th anniversary of the movie Field of Dreams. And with me is Sue Riedel. She was a location scout and local casting director for the movie Field of Dreams. She is artistic director and stage manager for Dubuque's Bell Tower Theater. We're going to talk with a couple of ballplayers in just a moment. But first, I want to read a couple of the emails that have been coming in. This is from Pam. This film hits home on a few different levels. As a native Bostonian and now adopted Iowan, I love that this movie combines both of my home states. Watching this movie is also the only time I have ever seen my dad cry. That line about "want to have a catch" hit something in him that not even my wedding could find. My grandfather had died when I was an infant, and my dad never really talked about him. Field of Dreams let me know how much my grandfather was loved and missed. And this is an email from Nick in Chicago. He says, the summer Field of Dreams filmed in Dubuque was pure magic for me. There was an electricity and charge that summer. Seeing the downtown mocked up like Boston amazed me, and friends and family in minor roles was so exciting. And I'm still tickled seeing some of the prop vehicles at the farmer's market 25 years later. The film is so timeless and beautiful. It depicts Iowa in such a wonderful, romantic, almost perfect way. And personally, from losing my own father to becoming a father myself, the film's story has grown in such fantastic and meaningful ways. You're welcome to share your thoughts and your memories as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Sue, we've been teasing that PTA meeting that you organized for quite a while. So let's listen to some of the sound from that very confrontational PTA meeting. At the meeting, Annie and Ray Kinsella have gone. The PTA is debating whether to ban all books by author and activist turned recluse Terrence Mann, who, of course, is played by James Earl Jones in the film.
Terrence Mann was a warm and gentle voice of reason during a time of great madness. He coined the phrase, make love, not war. While other people were chanting, burn, baby, burn, he was talking about love and peace and understanding. I cherished every one of his books, and I dearly wish he had written some more. And I think if you had experienced even a little bit of the 60s, you might feel the same way, too.
I experienced the 60s.
No, I think you had 250s and moved right on into the 70s.
Annie, look at this.
Oh, yeah? Well, your husband plowed under his corn and built a baseball field.
That's right.
Now, there's an intelligent response.
Annie.
The weirdo.
Annie.
Honey, it's all right. I'll be cool. At least he is not a book burner, you Nazi cow.
At least I'm not married to the biggest horse's ass in three counties.
All right, Beulah, do you want to step outside?
All right. That's a moment from the PTA meeting. Not very like many of the PTA meetings I've been to that takes place in the movie Field of Dreams. And Sue, you said it was not only a hot scene, but it was hot that day, huh?
Oh, it was so hot, and we had 500 people in in that scene, and they had to bring in those huge fans in to try and cool it down. But everybody was so good and so cooperative, and it was just a miserable day. Everybody was just soaked. And then we didn't get it all done in one day, so we had to make a big chart and put everybody's name and what they were wearing so we could match the shot. So we had to make sure that the next day you all came back in the same clothes and sat exactly the same place. And so that was Jim Meyer, who was an art teacher at Western Dubuque at the time, and being visual really helped. He helped me make that chart, and that we got everybody back in the right place so the shot matched the next day.
Well, I want to bring Paul Sherman into the conversation now. Paul was in the movie Field of Dreams as a baseball player, and then as time went on, he also became a ghost player at the film site Field of Dreams. He's also regional director of Robert's Kids and general manager for the semi-pro team, the Farley Hawks. Hello, Paul.
Hello. It's my pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you so much for being here today, and you had to tell a little lie to get into the movie, right?
Well, Sue didn't know that, but I think they're looking for players between 30 and 35, somewhere in that area, and I was 40, so I had to fabricate my birth date, but hopefully that didn't get me into too much trouble.
And what did you do in the film?
I was an extra baseball player. You know, we were the extra baseball players. 17 of us were in many background scenes, and I guess the scene that I can brag about is when Tim Busfield comes across the field, doesn't see the ghost players playing, almost gets hit by a baseball, and I grab the batter and make sure that he doesn't get a hold of Tim. So that's my claim to fame in the movie.
All right, and you were on set for 22 days.
I spent 22 days on the set, yes.
An average of 12 hours a day?
They were 12-hour days. Making movies isn't easy, I found out. You know, I believe, if I remember correctly, 8 hours of filming equals 1 minute on the screen. So you can, you know, translate that into a lot of time setting up and everything. There'd be some days that we wouldn't do anything. We were there just to make sure if Phil needed us, we would be there, you know, at his calling. So.
And Sue was talking about baseball practice. So did you get to practice with some of the people who came in from Hollywood and help them work on their baseball moves?
Yes. We practiced for a couple weeks before with the actors before we actually saw the set. And I guess the main concern was to get Ray Liotta's swing down to where it looked professional. And he worked diligently at that, and he was being coached by several different people, but he finally did improve his swing. He was serious, and he got that done.
And I want to bring your cousin, who has actually made a documentary about the ghost players, the people who performed at the Field of Dreams for 18 years after the movie was made. And, of course, there's still some ghost player action on occasion. Joe Sherman is on the line. Hi, Joe.
Hello, everybody, and how's Cousin Paul doing over there?
Fine.
All right. Now, I want the two of you to explain to me how the ghost players came about, because there was no plan to continue having baseball on this baseball diamond. And, of course, all of us know that the farmer who owned half of the diamond actually plowed it under that first year and planted corn. And then he had to go back and recreate the field. There have been many, many, many different plans for the Field of Dreams. But, Paul, maybe you better start. How did the ghost players get going?
Well, we can thank Keith Ray for keeping the dream alive with the ghost players. He had the idea, and he could certainly speak better to it than I can, but I know there were some people that showed up after the movie. They were looking for the field because people will come. They will most definitely come, and they did come. And he saw an opportunity to get some players out there and maybe draw some more people to the field. You know, that's just a soundbite of what he did, but Keith had this vision of getting the ghost players to appear at the field, and what has transcended since then is that we've appeared all over the world.
Well, it wasn't quite that fast. I mean, you started out at the field, Joe, and as I mentioned, you made a documentary about the ghost players. So tell me a little bit about the evolution. I mean, it was from a 1 week stunt And then it became a regular thing. And then all of a sudden, there these ghost players are traveling the world.
All right. Well, I'm sitting on my porch about 2 miles away, and we could see the lights when they were filming. And I knew my cousin Paul was over there, and a bunch of other friends were being these extras, but we couldn't get to the set. We could not get there. They had it sectioned off. So when the movie was over, I was curious, and we'd go over and see what the movie site was like. Well, our buddy Keith Ray, who lives near the field, got a couple of guys together. They got some old uniforms on, and they had a back road so they could drive around the back of the field. None of the tourists, which we didn't even call them tourists at that time, they were just a bunch of visitors out there, nobody saw them. So Keith and the guys would be back there, have these old uniforms on, and then they'd come walking up the cornfield and just appear. If you ever seen an Iowa cornfield, when you come through it, you actually just kind of appear. Right. And all these people are like, oh, my goodness, look at the ghost players are here. So they would come out and start playing ball with the people, and they'd hang out for about 15 minutes and they or a half hour. Then they go back to
and
that corn.
Nobody was making any money off that. That was just for fun?
I was just goofing off, and I heard about this. I heard these guys doing this. I go, you got to be kidding me. So I went out and videotaped them, and here they come out of the corn, and everybody's like, wow, look at them. They come out, and they play ball. They introduce themselves, and they kept getting longer and longer. Pretty soon they're out there for like an hour and a half. But what I thought was cool was they go back to that corn, tip their hats, wave goodbye, and thank everybody. We had a great time. And then they'd re-disappear again back into that corn. Now, people would run out to the parking lot thinking, well, they're going to show up at the parking lot. Well, they weren't. They were back in that back cornfield, back to their pickups, and they'd drive away. So they really appeared and disappeared. Nobody knew where they came from. So that was a blast. So I had to get it on tape.
Well, and you even filled in as a ghost player on occasion yourself, right?
Yeah, if they needed an extra laugh, they would let me play. Because I had a uniform. I had won a uniform in one of the Randy Hudley fantasy baseball camps. So I had a 1919 uniform. And then as they kept getting more popular, I would supply a PA system and wireless headsets. So I kind of had the uniform and I had the PA system and that. So I got to go along. It's kind of like I had the ball and glove and bat. So they took me along with them, even though I couldn't play.
Now, of course, those moments in the film where you see the ghost players are such dramatic and serious moments, really, for the most part. And
yeah, that's why I had to do the movie to show the other side.
Right, because this whole ghost player phenomena turned into really a comedy act, right?
Yeah, and while I was videotaping these characters and they got invited to go here, invited to go there, Keith would ask me to come along and help with production. So with that camera, I actually saw these guys transform from the old competitive ball players that I knew growing up into these teachers and instructors and comedians, and it was hilarious. I mean, I saw him for 20 some years just evolve.
And this did turn into a business, right?
Yeah, once I found out that I had all this footage and the State of Iowa Historical Society got interested in this footage, we figured we better save it. So we digitized the whole works. And out of that footage that we digitized and saved for historical purposes, we came up with the movie, which at one time was an hour and 15 minutes. I think we got it down to about 45 minutes now. But it's an historical record of the ghost players and the effects that they've had on so many people all over the world. It's been amazing.
Paul, what has it meant to you to be a part of this?
Well, it's meant that we've, like Joe said, we've been able to travel all over the world. But I think we have been able to extend the movie, the relationship part that, you know, fathers and sons don't have. Some locations that we go to for events, you talk to some father who hasn't bonded with his son, and you can do this in so many ways. You know, it's not just father son, it's mother daughter. It's just doing things together, and you know, spreading the word of what the movie was all about. And I think it's about a relationship, not necessarily just father-son, mother-daughter, and to make people laugh, too. Like Joe said, we have a comedy routine that the kids just, are great. They make everybody laugh. You forget about your troubles for an hour or so, and I think that's what we've done, part of what we've done anyway.
Well, and Sue, of course, usually when movie makers come to town, they do their thing, they leave, and that's pretty much that. Now, of course, with Field of Dreams, they left behind a field. I know there was a conversation for a little while right after the film came out. Universal talked about possibly buying that land and turning it into a public park, which may have saved a lot of controversy over the years if that had happened. But there have been different owners. There has been a lot of controversy over the years. Have you been surprised by how this site has endured and attracted people?
I'm very surprised, but I think it's Don helped that. He kept the field. You know, he had such a wonderful time that summer, and so he kept manicuring it, and people would just drive up, and he had a little notebook, and you could sign where you were from, and it was, and if he'd have some bats and balls there, and people would play, and it kind of grew. So I don't think anyone expected that a movie site would be there 25, well, it's now 26 years later since we filmed it.
Right.
And I always think that maybe, well, Don met his wife there. There have been lots of interesting, you know, beyond the field stories. She was a tourist that came, and they got talking, and he was single, and he did meet his wife there. People have gotten married on the field. People would call me up and say, would you come to my wedding? Perfect strangers. And you talked about, I took my dad there. My father's now passed away, but I remember playing catch with my dad, and I was on the girls' softball team. And so, you know, the field, it has a lot of memories for a lot of people. You know, we've all played catch as little kids with our parents and the relationships of playing catch. And I often think that maybe there should be a book about Beyond the Field or a sequel to the movie. And I know lots of movies have sequels, too, and this one didn't, and probably that's good because we still, our imaginations are there dreaming, you know, what is beyond that field. And we do believe that we can come, that we want that to be a real place, even though it's fictitious, but it has become a real place that people have comfort and feel good about. And I find that amazing, and it, for me, it obviously changed my life. I'm still talking about it.
Right.
Hey, Sue, it'd be a great play for you if you could make a play out of that.
Right, and so it's. I've done lots of speeches calling about fielding your dreams. You know, we all have dreams that we want to field, and baseball is a good analogy of how you can get to first base, second base, third base, and you try for that home run. And I think that's in all of our lives.
Well, Sue,
thank you. There is a good documentary out there, besides the Ghost Player one, but Tim Curseni worked on an ESPN documentary called Dreamfield. It's hosted by James Earl Jones. It's a really good documentary about the effects that the Field of Dreams has had on so many people.
Well, thank you all so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Well, thank you.
My pleasure.
Thank you for asking us.
Enjoy the 25th anniversary celebration, both the one at the Dubuque International Film Festival. There's a star-studded screening taking place tonight. And, of course, there'll be another celebration right around Father's Day this summer in Dyersville. Sue Rydell is Artistic Director and Stage Manager for Dubuque's Bell Tower Theater. She was also the location scout and local casting director for Field of Dreams. Paul Sherman was in the movie and was a ghost player for many years. Joe Sherman made a documentary about the ghost players of the Field of Dreams in Dyersville. With me now is Ben Kiefer. Quickly,
hi,
Ben,
Charity.
What's coming up on River to River?
Politics Day, of course. It's Wednesday. Politics Day. Mainly we'll be looking at the Supreme Court decision to uphold Michigan's ban on using race as a factor in college admissions, and we'd like to have our listeners' views on that decision, Charity.
All right. Sounds good. River to River today at noon. I'm Charity Nebbie.